Welcome back to another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Today on the podcast, I'm thrilled to have on two legendary watch collectors and dealers, Eric Koo and Justin Gruenberg. Of course, Eric is no stranger to Hodinkee, having appeared on the site, talking watches, and on this podcast. He got his start as a vintage dealer, soon founding 10 Past 10, way back in 2005. Most recently, he co-founded the online auction site Loop This in 2021. He's since become known for his expertise in Rolex, Cartier, and pretty much all things vintage. Of course, Eric's Loop This co-founder is today's other guest, Justin Gruenberg. Justin is a second-generation watch and jewelry dealer from LA, and since joining the family business, has also founded the vintage dealership The Keystone. Justin is widely admired for his wide tastes that run the gamut from vintage to modern, sport to dress, and pretty much everything in between. In today's episode, we talk about the most recent auctions, the market more broadly, what dealers and auctions can do better, but we also have a little fun. I get both of these guys to tell me what watch they'd love to snag from each other's collection. So without further ado, let's get to my conversation with Eric Koo and Justin Gruenberg. All right, so another episode of Hodinkee Radio. Thank you to Eric Koo and Justin Gruenberg, two real legends here, legendary dealers here in the United States, known currently, I would say, perhaps most as co-founders of Loop This, but we're going to get into their backgrounds a little bit more, and then we're going to have a lot of auction, market discussion, and just general fun watch discussion. Eric Koo, of course, is no stranger to Hodinkee Radio. I was looking back at the archives. You first appeared, I want to say, in 2018 after talking watches that you've done with us. Eric, how you doing?
Doing well. What about yourself, Tony?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for joining us. Excited to have you on once again. And then to those who know, Justin Gruenberg is kind of a legend in the Los Angeles watch scene. You know Gruenberg Watches, you know the Keystone, as I kind of introduced you, but you've never appeared on Hodinkee, which is a real shame. So I'm really excited to bring you on Hodinkee Radio for the first time. Justin, how you doing?
All good. Thanks for having me on, Tony.
Yeah, of course. So Justin, I want to start with you because you are kind of new to the Hodinkee world. And if you could just give us a little bit of a background on yourself. So I introduced you as Gruenberg Watches and the Keystone, but just tell us a little bit more about you and your business as a dealer.
Yeah. I grew up around watches. My dad had a jewelry store and a watch store in Beverly Hills since probably the late 60s. So as long as I can remember, I've been around watches and jewelry. And then in 2008, after, you know, coming back from school in New York, I started trading in mostly vintage watches at the time. And then a few years after that, Max Abbott and I created the Keystone, which we have been running ever since.
I want to just ask a little bit more about the Keystone, because if you're in watches, surely someone has dropped a beautiful photo of something that Keystone is selling in a group chat or a WhatsApp or something well known around the world. But can you just talk about sort of the impetus for starting the Keystone off of the back of what you and your family had built prior to that?
Sure. I've always kind of like had a lot of dealer relationships and kind of been focused on the wholesale market. And I had, an idea of, this is, I don't want to say like early watch website, because there are a lot of other, pre-owned watch websites at that time, but there weren't a million other watch websites that focused on like super high end. So we kind of decided to create the Keystone and kind of have more collector oriented watches via like a website. And that wasn't, it sounds crazy, but 2010, 2012, it wasn't, the most common thing.
Yeah, it makes sense. So Eric, I was trying to think of a good way to introduce you, obviously no stranger to the Hodinkee world. And I saw recently somewhere you recommended this episode of a podcast called The Acquired Podcast. It kind of analyzes businesses, oftentimes technology businesses, but not so much anymore. But you recommended an episode about LVMH, which was honestly one of the best sort of pieces of content I consumed in 2023 as well. And I'm wondering what you sort of thought of that episode, or high level takeaways you had about LVMH, the company or the conglomerate, and sort of how it applies to watches.
Yeah, I mean, for those of you that are not familiar with the podcast, they dive really, really deep into the companies that they cover. It's not uncommon for episodes to be 4 hours long, or 4 hours long, spanning into like episodes 1, 2, and 3 about a particular company. So, the podcast itself is a masterpiece. You know, the really interesting one that ties into our world, one of them is obviously LVMH. And it did a really deep dive into the beginnings of LVMH, Bernard Arnault, different points of progress that he made to be where he is today, the head of this luxury conglomerate to the likes that nobody's ever seen before, you know. And it's pretty interesting getting in a little bit into like the psyche of how LVMH operates. A few interesting takeaways, or one of the most interesting ones I thought, was that owning multiple brands, you can always have something on or off at the same time. So it seems like pretty interesting, like running one brand, for example, if Louis Vuitton was a standalone brand with standalone ownership, you know, they have to always be like constantly, you know, reinventing themselves, doing whatever. But as the head of a luxury group, you can, you know, assign different types of people to head different brands, target different market segments, and head in different like creative directions and things like that. And I think that's a really interesting way of running these type of luxury brands. And it's never really been done this way before, you know. Tying into watches in particular, I think of things like, you know, Bulgari certainly is under their umbrella. They make watches at multiple price points, from a few thousand dollars up until hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars. But then being part of a group allows them to do things like new projects, relaunching Gerald Genta, relaunching Daniel Roth, that clearly are super high-end brands that won't see, you know, aspirational models in the couple thousand dollar range.
Yeah, makes sense. And I view you both as sort of entrepreneurs in the watch space as well. In addition to dealers, you guys are much more than that with the companies you all have started. So I've got some sort of more business-oriented questions related to the watch industry towards the end of it. So stay tuned for that. Guys, I kind of wanted you all to come on right after the Geneva auction season, just to get sort of a general temperature check on the market. By the time this podcast runs, it'll be 2 weeks removed from the auction. So we're not going to get into the nitty gritty of lots too much, but I wanted to start by sort of, maybe we'll start with Justin here, and sort of as much as you paid attention to what was going on in Geneva, and then what will be coming up in Hong Kong and New York, sort of a general temperature check on how the secondary market and then the auction market is performing right now.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of funny because Eric and I used to be seasonal kind of auction attendees, and we're kind of giving a report from home. And, you know, I find this to be like a really interesting thing, because you don't have like you're not involved in kind of theatrical elements of like auctions to kind of feel the intensity in the room. Where my overall feeling is that, like, for super conditioned stuff, as it's been for quite a while, you know, it's bringing the price that it should bring. There is like a little bit of like, I don't want to say like, a selective or like a picky kind of audience. But most of the watches that should command the prices are commanding the prices. Occasionally, like you see like the 1463 at Anacorum, which was an incredible watch that I thought should have brought more money. But in general, like, I think that prices are pretty reflective of the market, which I find to be still strong. I mean, it has less speculative kind of aspects that it had, you know, 2 years ago, but I find that things in general are like, you know, doing well.
Eric, yeah, maybe you can pick it up there, because I think I saw you had even posted about this 1463, a yellow gold 1463. It was Eberhard signed, I think, that sold at Antiquorum for around 230,000 Swiss francs. And I think you said it was even, you know, one of the best cases you'd ever seen on that particular reference.
It certainly was. The price, was a bit disappointing, to be honest.
Really?
But I think that kind of reflects a general fatigue on certain vintage pieces. Yeah. You'll see a macro trend, I feel like, is that the way that the auctions are put together, there's less of an emphasis on vintage Rolex and vintage Patek, and more a broad spectrum of selection of watches with a lot more modern and contemporary, versus, you know, 3-4 seasons ago, you know, you could count a half dozen 2499s, a half dozen 1518s, seven-figure Patek Philippe, things like this. And the season this time around was much more balanced. You know, one of the things that I don't know what'll shake out from now and when the podcast gets released is certainly this mystery and intrigue surrounding what happened at Christie's and this website hack. you know, people will be dissecting this for a long time to come. Did they make the right choice to continue with the sales, doing only a watch without an online bidding component? People already expressed their opinions about this online on Instagram and social media. You know, a lot of people certainly weren't happy about the way things shook out. Particularly weird thing is that they allowed online bidding for the watch auction, but it was done via like a proprietary link. Website's still down. You could see it on YouTube and no published results or anything because the website's still down. So this is all really weird stuff, unprecedented. Nobody knows if it's a data breach, if, you know, our bidding histories are out there, passwords, who knows what. Yeah. But certainly this is a first for something like that, you know?
It's totally wild. And also just like coming off of sort of a lack of communication around the Passion for Time sale last November, I suppose. And then they had some rough results last November in Hong Kong as well. I've seen some articles in the Wall Street Journal and the Times about how the art market, because of all the Christie's auction sales or art sales are coming up soon, and how it's the last thing they really need when the art market is kind of stumbling along. And I think it's kind of no different in the art world. But do you think they've handled it well so far, or is it still kind of TBD from your perspective?
I don't want to be overly critical, but from my observational point of view, I think it could have been handled better.
Yeah.
There's a real lack of, you know, nowadays, people really crave like transparency or honesty about things. And I just feel like it's been really opaque how they've handled this. And, you know, I don't know when people dissect this later on, what's going to shake out, but, you know, I would have expected a little better communication. You know, like I said, with Only Watch, you know, there was one or two watchmakers already that kind of expressed their, unhappiness about the way things transpired. And I totally understand from a collector's standpoint. I have a lot of friends that wanted to bid on things online. They were unable to. Bid registrations were not fulfilled. And these are all like highly problematic for an auction house, you know. There certainly were a lot of smaller brands that really didn't get a fair shake in the Only Watch, in my opinion. There were a few things that Hammer kind of in that low $50,000 to $100,000 range could have probably done more. I was a bit surprised at the result from that Bulgari Octo Finissimo. I went to this release event for that watch when they unveiled it last year. And the thing is really, really impressive object. And it's one of the coolest things that I've seen in a long time. And, you know, it did a quite a good result, 250,000. But at the same time, I would have expected that to do more, you know.
It seemed like under the right circumstances, if the Only Watch stuff had not happened, hadn't been postponed, like, could that have pressed seven figures even?
I mean, I thought it would be 500,000 to a million easily.
Okay. You know, I had a question for you guys about Only Watch, and maybe since we're here, I can just ask it real quickly, because it was originally scheduled for November. We've covered a little bit on the website how it was delayed, questions about financial improprieties, or just, and then there was an audit, some sort of corporate restructuring. And I know you guys have been sort of, at least one of you has been supportive of Only Watch in the past, but I'm just curious what you guys think the future of a charity auction like this should be, if it should have a future.
I mean, you know that saying, snitches get stitches, right? No, I'm just kidding. but, you know, it's unprecedented, the scrutiny that everybody faces now from social media. Only Watch certainly is a perfect example of this. I've followed this just, you know, by reading everything everybody else has on the internet, you know, Instagram comments back and forth and things like that. And, you know, I don't really have an informed opinion about, you know, what happened actually. I understand that some sort of an audit was performed. I'm not really an expert on corporate due diligence, so I don't really know, you know, what came out of that. But, you know, certainly the event went forward. They lost some support from a few of the bigger brands. You know, I don't know. This is just speculation here, but I feel that it's very difficult for something like this to continue going forward. And I don't really know what the future of Only Watch is going to be like if they lose the support of, you know, some of the bigger brands.
Yeah. Justin, anything to add?
Whether it's due to malfeasance or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, my take on this is that, like, I'm pretty late to the gossip. Typically, like, it's usually happens in a call, like the Eric calls me and he's like, hey, did you hear about this shit? And I'm like, Wow, that's pretty crazy. Regarding the only watch, I mean, I think that, you know, they were audited, as they say. I have no idea about their financials. Hopefully, you know, everything is as it should be, but you never know. I always found it a little bit uninteresting, not to say that I'm super happy about, like, you know, all of these record prices for charity, but I kind of feel like the actual, you know, like, I kind of forget what the watch is 3 years later that brought the record price. I was even talking to Eric and I was like, what was that? Was it like a 6,300 that brought, you know, 30 something million that year, or what was the model? And it reminds me of like that Fran Lebowitz, Netflix, where she said something along the lines of like, people applaud, the price, but not the Picasso, where it's just like, I can't even remember some of these record things, just the price. And for watches, I find that to be like, not that interesting.
Yeah, it's the standard art collector quip where you, you know, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing, right? It's not so dissimilar, I would say. But you know, the word audit has come up far too many times for my taste. So we're gonna move on, I think. And I wanted to talk to you guys a little bit more about just what you feel, first of all, the traditional auction houses are doing well right now, and then what you feel as though they're not doing well, or maybe put more positively, what you feel as though the opportunities are for them to better serve the market or collectors, I suppose.
I mean, there's no doubt that every season I'm just like shocked by how many great watches are showing up, you know, between Christie's, Phillips, you know, Antiquorum this year, Monaco Legends. There are substantial amount of important watches that continuously are appearing. I think the problems we're facing is just like the level of transparency and the cost. You know, when you have certain issues that are raised about watches, it seems like sometimes they're not addressed in kind of an academic way. And then on the cost side, you have, you know, 27% buyer's premium, mostly, or you have a 10% seller's premium with Sotheby's now. So I think that these things are a little bit debilitating to, you know, conduct business to a certain extent.
Can I ask you about kind of some of the big news in the auction world, to really get into the inside baseball of it for just a second, is Sotheby's kind of changed their fee structure. So now it's what, a 20% buyer's premium. But then on the other side, what they did is they kind of changed their seller's premium so that it's 10%, which these are kind of just numbers, but I'm curious from your guys's perspective, if you could kind of explain why this matters, and then kind of why actual sort of enthusiasts or collectors that might be listening to this podcast should care about something like this.
In my personal opinion, it doesn't really change anything. It's just the perception of things. The reason why I say that is it's like, basically the auction houses typically take like a third of the pie for themselves, you know, roughly 30% from one side or the other. And what Sotheby's has stated publicly is that the premium is 20% on the buyer side, which psychologically it's like, oh, 20 versus the 26 or 7%, it's a lot lower. But then on the other hand, they are making like a mandatory seller's premium of like a 10%. You know, a tiered 10% or whatever it is on the back end. And at the end of the day, they're taking the same amount of money. It's just the way that they're allocating it is like different. And if you're looking at it as a buyer, right, ultimately you pay what you pay. Like when I buy things at auction, I calculate the buyer's premium, what I pay. So it just, I adjust my bids accordingly that way, you know? And if anything, it's just the seller side perception of going from, hey, I have a 5% fee, or they've waived my fees, or I've gotten a hammer share on something, to, hey, there's this mandatory 10%, kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth, maybe, you know?
For you all, presumably you guys have longstanding relationships with all these auction houses, Sotheby's included. I guess I'm making some assumptions here, but has it changed your relationship with Sotheby's at all, the way in which they're changing this? Or have they sort of taking care of existing clients in a way to make sure that they continue to sort of want to do business with them?
I mean, I think of the scenario of like the old woman with like a Picasso in her house or something like that, like a Cartier crash or whatever. They're going to take it to two or three different auction houses. And then I think to the uninformed person, When they say that they're going to be charged a fee for selling it with them, it's like an instant turnoff. So I don't understand the logic behind this decision. I don't know, but it's certainly like very intriguing. It's either the most brilliant or the dumbest thing that's ever been done. And I can't tell which one it is, you know?
You guys are both sitting in your offices, it looks like, and something we often do on this show is show us something cool on your desk, basically. And you guys both have like a lot of cool random stuff sort of on and around your desk. I'm wondering if we could just play this game real quick for both of you.
Okay. So I'm not going to go pick it up because it's kind of fragile. But one thing that I really love is you'll see this fishbowl behind me.
Yep.
This is a 50s, early 60s Rolex display for a waterproof watch. There was an Annie Quorum sale many years ago called Rolex Mania. It was Omega Mania and then Rolex Revolution, excuse me. It was a watershed moment in the history of collecting vintage Rolex. I had come to own a lot of these really cool 50s and 60s displays, and I put them all in the auction and sold them. And the two most iconic ones, in my opinion, are the fishbowl with the Neptune trident behind me. And then there was another one of like a water bowl with like a lily pad around it. And I was really regretful of selling these things. So a few years ago, I found this one and then bought it back because I just thought it was something really cool to have. And it's been sitting on my desk, the bureau behind me, like collecting dust for the last 10 years. I don't know that I've even touched it, but it's something certainly fun to look at.
Oh, that's great. Didn't disappoint. Justin, what about you?
I guess it's mostly just books, because sometimes we'll come across something that we have to reference in a book, but I have this clock right here, which is one of my favorites that I have, which I bought from, I think it came from like the Oahu, Hawaii library or something like that. And it's a Patek clock, looks to be stone, but I don't think it is. I think it's a faux stone. I have it in this color and blue and red, and I kind of love these like solar era clocks. Some of them are solar and some of them aren't, but
do you know what era it's from?
In the 70s.
Yeah, that's super cool. Okay. Well, thank you for that, guys. I use it as a transition because I know you both chose watch sort of objects there or watch related ephemera, but you guys are sort of known to collect other things and dabble in other categories as well. And one of the things I'm always interested in is what watches might learn from other more established categories of collecting. One of the common sort of themes you hear is that watches are this more nascent collecting category. And if you look at more established areas of collecting, you might be able to sort of tell what the trajectory of watches might be, but there might be certain things you can take or learn from them. And I'm curious sort of as collectors in some of these other areas, something that you think they might have that maybe watches could perhaps learn from. Justin, maybe you could start.
Yeah, I mean, I have a personality that like once I look at one thing, I kind of try to look at other things in a similar respect, whether it's like art or design or coffee or whatever it might be. I kind of tend to geek out on all the details of something. So in terms of learning, I think that, although like I feel like there was, has some history of kind of academia in watches, I think that like we have a lot to go in terms of like having like an academic background to our work. And I think that that's it affects like condition reporting. It affects like the amount of information in terms of like production numbers, in terms of, just because I always feel that like the more information that clients have and collectors have is better for the market. I think my father's era, it's like, basically like the customer knows nothing, and we should basically tell them what it is. I think it's actually the opposite now, and I think like having a lot of information and a lot of good information out there is the most important thing for the market and for pricing. So I think that we have a lot of long ways to go in terms of like an academic foundation for our work, which you see in art when you can get a third party, so you can get a third party to give condition reports that are not, have no financial kind of logic for them to be giving, you know, poor information. Where here, I feel like there's in our industry, sometimes certain facts are omitted that should be, you know, included clearly. And I think that, you know, these type of things are important for us to kind of move forward.
I mean, I think like all collectible categories go through this trajectory of growth. And, you know, you had said that, you know, Tony, that watch collecting is kind of, you know, like a young hobby or, you know, vertical, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, I'm going to disagree a little bit with that. I'd say that it's something that people have been doing for a long time. It's just evolved significantly. And the reason why I say that is I feel like, for example, pocket watches have been collected for a very long time.
Yeah.
You look at even Henry Graves, the super complication and whatever. At that time, it was a scholarly pursuit of making something like testing the extremities of like human ingenuity, of like making these complications of new systems of like, you know, escapement systems for movements, all this type of stuff. And it was literally like old guys in smoking jackets having philosophical discussions about like Abraham Louis Breguet, things like that. You know, what happened now? You know, people are talking about colored dials, and that's like the new hot thing. And it's gone through like many phases. I mean, I think of even art, you know, thousands of years ago, you know, art was really a scholarly pursuit. And then, you know, the Renaissance period, there was this real influx of like new knowledge and all these things that happened. It was a real scholarly thing versus now, you know, contemporary art, a lot of it is, you know, people don't understand. And it's more about the value, like you had said, of something versus the art itself or something like that, you know?
It sounds like you're asking, where are the scholars today?
I think it's just the evolution of collecting, you know?
Yeah.
People certainly, when Basquiat hit the scene in the early mid 80s, you know, people were not understanding that art, and now whatever, 40 years later, you have people writing scholarly dissertations about, you know, a Basquiat scribble or like a Warhol chalk drawing on a subway wall that probably the artist never intended, but, you know, there's an analysis on everything, you know? There might be an analysis later on about during this era of the early 20s and during COVID, why people just suddenly like colored dials and watches. I mean, you know?
Well, I was going to ask you to make the parallel on watches for me. You kind of got there a little bit, but is it just like, there's one theory in which we're kind of just moving forward through the generations. Like people used to collect these pocket watches, and then we moved on to sort of the masterpieces from 30s and 40s era wristwatches from Patek and whatever else, and continue to move forward. And now we're like, we're in the 70s, I guess, right now still. But I don't know. Is that kind of just like one of the general themes or no?
I mean, there's also this thing of like getting back into the LVMH podcast. Okay. There's a difference between like a luxury brand and like an aspirational brand. And I feel like in the old days, like, it was like 10 people collecting these pocket watches in the world, okay? And then now there are millions of people collecting watches. It's because of the information that's afforded to us, the relative, you know, varied price points of watches. You know, people collect $5 watches, they collect $5 million watches. And it's gotten to this, you know, this point with just consumerism in general that, you know, it's become more, I hate this word democratized, but it's like this thing that like everybody has a piece of at a different time, you know?
Yeah. Justin, you were talking about more information, number one, disclosure, but also just like having more information, I think. Maybe this is from manufacturers about production, and maybe it's also just collectors and dealers and writers and stuff documenting things better. But I'm curious, maybe this is a self-indulgent question, is like I'm asking you to pitch me a potential article even, but like areas of collecting that sort of feel as though they're like under-documented now, or there's just not enough information for people to seriously kind of do it as a more serious endeavor.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you just take the high categories of watches and you kind of make the parallel to art, like Eric was saying, you take a Basquiat or you take a, you know, a 60s Warhol, you can find books that are written about a Jackie Kennedy Warhol, which is like, you know, for a Jackie, is the price of a 1518, a nice 1518. And there's not a whole lot of literature being written about 1518s that's public. You can go and buy, you know, probably three books that are, you know, have chapters about a Jackie and what potentially Warhol, you know, how his whole practice, you know, with the foundation of that in terms of, you know, the artwork. So I find that like there's a lot of literature that needs to be, to be made, I think, to kind of justify, you know, this category, because obviously we have like consumption of watches is a little bit different than art, but I think that, you know, a lot of people are interested in, you know, the background of these watches and, you know, what an original dial, what are the specs of an original dial? And that information isn't all too public.
One thing that I'd like to point out that I thought was a really great thing is, I don't know if any of you guys have looked at this website that AP put out called like AP Chronicles.
Yeah.
And it's really an unprecedented thing for a manufacturer to do. And I think a lot of brands should really make a case study of what like AP did with that. If you're not familiar, AP Chronicles is this kind of historical website that they set up. You know, right now they're kind of documenting the Royal Oaks because that's like the hot thing, but it gives all of the reference numbers, production figures, and things like that, that traditionally are information that the brands hold very close to their chest. But I don't see why they should be doing that. You know, you always see in an auction catalog, possibly unique, one of five known to the market. You know, these are not like hard facts, you know? And I don't think there's anything wrong with Patek Philippe going out there and saying, you know what, we produced 357 2499s total. You know, these numbers and data points are what collectors crave, you know? And without this stuff, the speculation out there is sometimes like grossly overestimating production, grossly underestimating production. Like these things are what is needed by collectors to give them reassurance about the marketplace.
I have a question about that, because one of the things you often hear as a counter to that is vintage Rolex, especially if Rolex, maybe it's different because the production numbers are so much higher, but the sort of counter is if Rolex ever actually came out and said, we made this many Paul Newman Daytonas, for example, it would completely like blow up the market for a lot of these watches because so many would be called into question. Do you take that sort of with any seriousness, Eric?
I mean, so we're using the example of Rolex, and I'll tell you of any brand, you know, Rolex is in my eyes, the finest produced, like industrially made product there is, you know, and they're made on an industrial scale, not like Patek Philippe. So for those people thinking that there's only a couple hundred Paul Newman dials out there, tens of thousands, maybe more, who knows, you know, but like, I don't know. I mean, I think this data, it's stuff that people want to know about, you know, and it's better off dispelling the misnomers out there now than letting these legends and whatnot like get out of control. You know, I can't think of a specific example right now, but a perfect thing would be, let's say there was a particular watch or a particular dial type that comes up on the market and they're like the only example, possibly unique, right? What happens? Something possibly unique goes to auction and then sells for $5 million, then you know what? That's a lot of impetus for people to be digging around and finding another example. And more often than not, like this happens, you know? So I think it should be information that's shared with collectors by the manufacturers as much as possible.
I have one potential example for you, Eric. Was this sort of champagne albino gold Rolex that was at Phillips? I think it passed, right? And I know you have some familiarity with the steel albinos. So I'm wondering if, is that a potential example or maybe even just like what sort of happened with that watch and why it passed?
The watch is beautiful. It looks correct to me in terms of like the forensic things that I'm like looking at. Yeah. But I think right now what the market craves is steadfast, like facts and forensic kind of like historical evidence. And something that is undocumented like that, that shows up from nowhere so far, like after production, it's just like, it takes a lot of time to digest and accept. I think it's the right watch for the wrong market timing, to be honest. I mean, this watch came up many times in conversations between Justin and myself and other dealers and collectors. And, you know, a watch like this coming to market, you know, a few years ago, or let's say debuting at the Daytona sale at Christie's, you know, it could have done seven figures easily. But, you know, right now, the uncertainty that people have about that watch kind of outweigh the beauty of it, I guess. I mean, it's funny that when that watch passed, I don't know if you guys were watching, but Aurel on the rostrum had made some sort of comment that's like, yeah, maybe it's too exotic for everybody, or but maybe it's too special or something like that, you know, which is really appropriate, I think.
So maybe we'll see it again, huh?
We will probably see it again.
There's not as much momentum as there once were for sport Rolex also.
Well, this is a question I wanted to ask you guys, is about just sports Rolex. I know you guys both kind of got your start in this space, but sort of, yeah, just double click on that thought for a second, Justin.
I mean, when I first started to buy a, you know, like a 1680 or a 5513 in like mint condition was like a holy grail for me. There was nothing that like brought a bigger smile on my face than finding like a super orange Lume 5513. And now it's like my focus on Rolex is non-sports. Like my interest is in bubble backs, you know, Ovatones, early chronos that are, you know, small and undesirable. Like these are kind of what I'm super passionate about now. So it's kind of, you know, like I've talked about it before, that like the collecting kind of goes in waves, where you're like, for at least for me, where I'm obsessed with certain categories, and then I kind of move on from them and then come back. So not to say I'm done with sports forever, but I think my passion is a little bit changed over the last couple of years.
Well, and it sounds like you're kind of reflective of the broader market. I mean, I mentioned Eric when you were last on the podcast in 2018. That was the first 20 minutes of the discussion, is when is vintage Rolex going to slow down? It seemed like there was no end in sight, and you know, it slowed down shortly thereafter, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, there's just a bit of fatigue. If you look, vintage Rolex had this unprecedented growth curve for the last 10 years at least, you know. And, you know, it's good to take a breather every once in a while. But the fact is a no-date Submariner is always going to be an iconic watch. And, you know, people will come back to this stuff at some point. But it just, you know, it went too high too quickly, you know, multiplied with during COVID, you know, all this type of stuff. It was a confluence of like the perfect storm where prices just got out of hand and they just weren't sustainable at those levels, you know.
If you take like an RCO from like 2014, it would be an over $1 million watch, right, Eric? And then like this Cloisonné Rolex at Phillips would probably be half of what it brought in that same period. That there's kind of been a reversal of kind of pricing in terms of like these 40s, 50s watches, important ones, being worth the price of the most important Neumanns or... But then you have certain things like a JPS, which is still has proven to be over $1 million watch multiple times at this point. So certain watches have kind of stood the test of times, and then others haven't. An Orange Hand, it was $25,000, a nice one, when I started in 2008. It's practically the same price as it is now.
I mean, I'd argue that they've actually gone down a little bit in price in some of these kind of like basic sport watches, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think like there's a few different things. You bring up the like the RCO, Oyster Soto, whatever you guys want to call this. And I feel like what's really shaken the market on that is basically half of them, if not more, are fake. You know, taking a 6264 Daytona dial and cleverly printing the word Oyster underneath Cosmograph in the right font can make a watch go from $200,000 to $1 million. And the, you know, the confidence in the marketplace for watches like that, that are very rare, but, you know, fairly easily faked to a confidence level of, let's say, 85% or something, you know, it's just shaken the confidence in those type of watches, you know? So that's one thing with a really high end. Tony, you look like you're about to jump in here.
I had a question because you posted, it's on the same topic, but a little bit different. Towards the end of last year, towards the end of 2023, you posted about these like very scary, good fake stone dials. And I want to ask about sort of that area of the market as well. And just like what even the impetus was for posting something like that, because it's kind of outside the norm for you or any dealer to post something that's like just a PSA, watch out type of thing.
I posted that because at that time, dealers such as Justin and myself and then other colleagues had been seeing a proliferation of stone dials and like really, really high quality, but something slightly wrong with them, you know, or the fonts are slightly off or something like that. And the truth is these things were coming onto the marketplace and being passed off as original. And I would say probably they would fool 90 to 95% of collectors and dealers. So the reason why I posted that was I saw them coming to market in sufficient quantities to know that, you know, this, I mean, it's become like, I don't know, like a criminal enterprise, if you will, like people making these, trying to pass them off as real onto the marketplace. And, you know, that also shakes the confidence in the market for stone dials, for example.
My question is, where in the market is this happening? Where is the stone dial going from like, this was a fake watch into like someone is essentially like laundering it into representing it as a real or authentic Rolex stone dial? Does that make sense?
Well, I mean, 15 years ago, a coral dial day-date in yellow gold was like a, you know, $20,000 watch, let's say. It's worth double what a normal one was at the time. Now, multiple times, coral dial day-dates are selling $100,000 to $200,000. You know, the motive is certainly just the price there. You know, you can take a $10,000 day-date and with some trickery on the dial, 10x your money, 20x your money. And, you know, this goes hand in hand with like restoration, right? It's like, at what point does restoration become like kind of this gray area of criminality, if you will? You know, it's like people have found a way to make these stone dials look very convincing and, you know, started putting them on the market because, you know, nobody's like looking, you know. Nobody's looking close enough, I should say.
So you guys founded Loop This together. And I'm curious sort of what the impetus you all saw and what the opportunity was you all saw in the market to do something different as far as starting an online auction house that had a flat seller's fee, 10% buyer's premium, and sort of the opportunity that you all took on there.
Loop This was a conversation between Eric several years before it came to fruition, I would say, based on just us seeing a growing appetite in terms of watches to be, you know, bought in auction all year round, every day of the year, rather than kind of a seasonal model. And we kind of saw that based on a model that we can cut the commission significantly to operate a 10% profit, 10% premium and a $500 listing fee for the consignor. We have like a streamlined operation that allows for that, I would say, where obviously if you're sending paper catalogs to, you know, 2,000 households around the world, you can't operate at that business model potentially. We, you know, obviously all of our watches are sold online. So we have a little bit more leeway to operate at that level.
Yeah, you know, I was flipping through an old auction catalog from 1995 or 6 the other day. A lot of things stood out, obviously, the prices and how low they were. But one of the things that really stood out was the 10% buyer's premium. So taking it back to as it once was, I suppose. I'm curious what you guys, now that you've been in business for a few years, learnings you had or mistakes you kind of made that you learned from along the way, just as either as watch people or just as sort of business people or entrepreneurs.
I mean, one thing that I'd say is that the reason why it took so long for us to launch the site from when we were talking about it initially was like, there's so many different ways to slice the pie here, you know. Before we launched the website and then until we launched and after, you see there's like a lot of other kind of auction platformy type websites, you know, doing trying to do what we do, doing what we do, you know, to varying degrees of success. And I think like the one thing that's really important and that we're quite proud of is that the formula that we decided on is what works for us. And it's proven that it's worked for the 3.5 years that we've been up, because a lot of these other ones, they want to build a marketplace where buyers post their own things, sellers bid on them, and they kind of like take a commission in between, you know, those type of platforms, like using the words escrow, they like using the words, you know, third party verification, like all these type of things. But really, in our eyes, it's like passing the responsibility on to like another party, you know. And then what we have come up with is like this hybrid model of, it's like a traditional auction house in that, you know what, you're buying the goods from us. You're not buying it from the consigner, and we are fulfilling your order. Like, you know who Justin and Eric are. Like, you're not going to worry about getting an empty box. You're not going to worry about getting like a fake watch, because we're the ones like fulfilling like the orders directly, versus like doing a third party authentication, holding payment for escrow, all these type of things. And, you know, to this day, that like all the other similar type of websites in our sphere are basically just trying to use that marketplace model that I don't necessarily think is the right model for us, you know? And so like that explains like the long gestation of our project, but I'm really proud of the results that came out of it.
Another thing I wanted to ask you guys, Eric, you've started a few businesses in the space now, LA Watchworks, we just talked about Loop This, your dealership 10 past 10, Justin, same thing, family business, and then the Keystone and now Loop This. To me, we've been talking about the growth of the watch industry and how the trajectory sort of looks to be positive over the long term if you zoom out. I'm curious from your guys' perspective as potential problems or opportunities for new businesses to be started in the watch space, whatever they might be. Surely it's something you guys have thought of at some level.
Yeah, I mean, not in necessarily a business that I'm like involved in, but I do like seeing a lot of these younger dealers. You know, back in the day, you used to say that our business has like a huge barrier of entry. And I think there is certain financial barriers of entry, but you see a lot of young dealers that are coming into our space and like really having, I would say, like very personal elements of the watches that they sell. There you have like, you know, somebody, Mr. A on Instagram or Carlos Diary, Palooka, like they're kind of have a very, you know, specific development of how they want to, you know, show the clients and collectors, you know, what they want to sell. It's not like a, you know, like this old era of dealer, which, you know, has like basically anything you come across. I really like looking at these Instagrams and also websites that have very focused, you know, missions. Not necessarily a huge scalable model, but one that I find to be like an important model as a dealer.
For me, the most important thing is the most concerning thing or threat or whatever you want to call it is the lack of watchmakers these days.
Yeah.
You know, I am a co-owner of LA Watchworks, and we're always trying to hire qualified watchmakers to join our staff. And it really is quite difficult. I think in the United States, the three main watchmaking schools graduate, I want to say like 3 or 4 dozen students a year in total. So really, you know, like most of them go work for Patek Philippe or Rolex, some other brands and whatnot. But really, long-term third-party serviceability of watches is going to be an issue moving forward. And I don't know, like, it doesn't seem like young people these days are interested in trade jobs, you know, like, but watchmaking is a really important and central part of, you know, what we're talking about today, what all of our businesses involve. And I just think that, you know, through the involvement of organizations like HSNY and other things, like we really, it's very important to spread the message about, you know, watchmaking and that career as like a possible career path for people.
Yeah.
Because when we don't have watchmakers anymore, then we're really going to have a lot of problems.
I've got a couple of fun questions left for you guys, and then I'll let you get out of here. But in addition to sort of dealing and Lupus and all of that type of stuff, you're passionate collectors of all kinds of different watches. And I'm curious, I want both of you to sort of hopefully answer this question. One watch that you would love to have, Eric, for you, one watch you'd have to love to have from Justin's collection that maybe you've even tried to buy and he just won't let you sell. And then Justin, obviously the same question for you, vice versa, a watch that you'd love to be able to snag from Eric's collection, if only he'd let you. It looks like Eric's a little bit readier to talk, so maybe I'll ask him first.
All the secrets are coming out, I guess, you know. Yeah. You know, both Justin and I love vintage Cartier. You know, they compose like a large portion of our collections. And one of the watches that I really love of Justin's is this this really funky like Cartier London watch that I think is a decagonal 10-sided case with a very weird, like totally swinging 60s dial motif of like a dark gray and white swirl with numbers like I think 1 through 24 on the dial. That watch is a really unique watch that I'd never seen before and just is fantastic, and I would love to own it. But you know, we can't have everything. So
yeah, I would say that probably in the same realm of Cartier, Eric has a Tank Centre, like a medium size white gold London, that for me is the perfect watch. If I, you know, somehow lost everything else, I'd hope that that watch would somehow appear at the same time, and I'd be equally as happy, because I always go back to those simple Normals or Tank Centres. So I would say that one day, probably after like an exhausting 3-day without sleep, I might be able to convince Eric to sell it to me.
Cartier London for both of you, which is kind of fascinating, sort of the enduring appeal of Cartier London, I suppose. Can you just kind of, maybe one of you just talk a little bit about like what it is about that specific era of Cartier and that specific workshop?
I mean, there's two things. A is the designs, like, you know, obviously Cartier London came up with like the Crash. That's a perfect example of design. And B is like the craftsmanship or process of which these watches were made. You know, the English historically aren't really known for efficiencies in manufacturing, and it's can be seen on these watches because each watch was made from, you know, made by hand. It wasn't like they had an industrial line where they were stamping cases and finishing them in a normal method. It's like if somebody ordered a Crash, they would take like a mold and like, and they would make a Crash, make a deployant buckle and do all this. So that's why you could have two Tank Normals next to each other, both made in London, you know, on different days, and they would be slightly different. If you took the deployant clasp apart, the two blades, there's a high chance that they wouldn't be interchangeable with each other because they were just like made by hand, you know? And it's like on Monday, like John was smoking a cigar at his bench making it, he hammered it a little too much. You know, on Wednesday, like the guy had to pick up a phone, he didn't hammer it enough. So there's all these little things that are flaws in the industrial process, but charming when you look at it from a collectible point of view, you know?
Does that just totally distinguish it from the stuff that Cartier was making in Paris at the same time?
Yep. If you compare like side-by-side watches of, say, a simple Tank Louis, the proportions, the dial design, they have a like, I don't think maybe you'll notice unless you have them side by side, but they're the Louis from London. There's something really like kind of special about it and timeless. I have a lot of, you know, 20s, 30s Cartiers, and, you know, a handful of them feel like I'm wearing a watch from like a shipwreck or something, because it feels like it's from a different time period. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily hold up in the same like modern way that a London watch does. You can take a watch from the 60s or 70s and it might as well be made now in terms of the sophistication of the design, the proportions. It kind of balances what's like historical and old and what's modern for me.
One of the most fascinating watches to me is this supposed Rolex that Frank Mueller modified into being a QP, and it popped up probably about 10 years ago, and we've seen it on Jay-Z's wrists since then. In the past couple of years, I've seen old auction catalogs from the early 90s appear, in which the watch that appear in those auction catalogs do not look like the watch on Jay-Z's wrist. And you've left comments that seem to indicate that you may or may not know that there's more to the story about this watch. And I'm curious, I've always wanted to ask you this question, and I'm curious if there's anything more there.
If I get shot after talking about this, just please run with the segment.
Yes, please.
Yeah, you'll notice in the original auction catalog that it was sold, it has like a bronze dial.
Yeah.
And then the one that had been floating around on Instagram, you see, has this kind of grenade, you know, like eggshelly looking dial. It's not the same watch. The one that Frank Mueller made, it exists. I had followed where it was, like it was in laying dormant in a collection for a very long time, I'll say. And I believe it's still there. And you know, the funny thing is that we have mutual friends, and the one that is floating around that was on Jay-Z's wrist at some point that he may or may not own. If you ask Frank Mueller himself, he will say, "I did not make this watch." So I think that pretty much answers that question.
That makes sense. Kind of
wraps it all up, because the reason why Eric is not able to go to Switzerland anymore, because him and Frank Mueller have an agreement that if he's going to talk openly about this, he has to stay out of the country.
Exactly.
Guys, I wanted to ask you one more thing if you've got the time for it, because while you're known in the watch world as excellent dealers and entrepreneurs and all these things, you're just men of the culture as well. And I want to ask you guys for a cultural recommendation that may or may not have anything to do with watches. Maybe it's content you consumed, just anything sort of outside of the world of watches that you found interesting lately. Justin, maybe I could start with you.
I mean, I'm always like looking at design and art. When, you know, practically I look at those auctions as much as I do watch auctions, and not to say that that's like my out of work interest. I just kind of, I'm always interested in learning about how these things like overlap, how art dealers and art auctions sell their work in comparison to how we sell our work, the processes that are in place there. So I'd say that in general, like art is where I'm, you know, most fascinated. I would say like 60s, 70s work post-war for the most part.
Give me one artist that from the 60s or 70s right now that you're particularly into.
I've been reading a lot of books on Warhol.
Okay.
And this is like one of those things that you grow up seeing Warhols in institutions and museums, and you're like either uninterested or it's just like kind of in the back of your head always. And my mom's an artist, but my dad is kind of like, what is all this crap on the wall of these museums type of person, you know, that guy that like just like sees all contemporary art as being a waste of time potentially, or a cheap way. The more I read about them, the more fascinated and interested I am. So I'd say for me, Warhol at the moment is my thing.
Eric, same question to you.
I've mentioned this already today, and I am unaffiliated. I'm not making any money off of this, but really this acquired podcast is fantastic. You know, I was introduced to this by a good friend of mine, Michael Weisberg, and, you know, currently they did 12 hours on Nintendo, the company. So, I mean, just to show you how in-depth these people are, I'm maybe 6 hours into the story right now, but it's a really great podcast, and it's something that you can listen to in the car, subway ride, pick up whenever, and it's just really great. I mean, you know, calling it a podcast doesn't even do it justice, but, you know, they go through and talk about a lot of different types of companies. We used the example of LVMH today, but it's not about luxury. It's about like any sort of company. That's the thing that I've been obsessed with the most lately.
Thanks for making it full circle, because that's what I asked you at the top. You know, I recently listened, they published an episode about Hermes recently to kind of bring it back to watches, roughly speaking. And I'd recommend that one to anybody as well.
But that ties to the LVMH episode too.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Like two different ways to go about luxury. But you'll have to listen to all 10 hours of podcasts or whatever that was to see what we mean. Well, listen, thank you guys so much. Thanks to Eric. Thanks to Justin for coming on and playing along. I probably could have done this for another hour, but I know you guys are busy. So thank you so much for taking the time. And thank you all to listening. Thanks to our editor, Vic Ottomanelli, as always. And we'll see you again next week for another episode of Hodinkee Radio.
Thanks a lot, Tony. Thanks for having us.